Hello and welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast in which Lowy researchers and leading thinkers and policymakers delve into the big issues in international affairs. I'm Hervé Lemieux, the Director of Research at the Lowy Institute. And today we'll be doing something a little different. We'll be taking a step back to explore a very unique period in the history of Australian foreign policy, one dominated by a single man, Bob Hawke. With me to discuss this very flawed, very talented man is the acclaimed author and journalist Troy Bramston, who has just published his book, Bob Hawke, Demons and Destiny, came out in March, on the man himself and his foreign policy implications and legacy in particular. Troy is a senior writer and columnist with the Australian newspaper. He was previously a columnist with the Sunday Telegraph. He's also a prolific author and has published 11 books, including his latest, Bob Hawke, but also Robert Menzies, The Art of Politics, and Paul Keating, The Big Picture Leader. Troy, give us a sense, for those of us who, like me, are not originally Australian or may not even have been alive in 1983 when Hawke came to power, why was this man such a game changer? And more importantly, paint a picture for us of his complexity. This was a man of evident talents, of huge political triumphs, but also of some very real human shortcomings.
Well, Hervé, it's great to talk to you on this podcast. Look, Bob Hawke was a larger-than-life figure, a very dynamic, innovative figure in Australian public life for several decades. He was born in Border Town in 1929. His father was a clergyman, his mother was a schoolteacher, and they invested in him this belief that he was destined for greater things. His mother thought he would be the Prime Minister one day. So this sort of carried with him through life. He galloped through school and university, became a Rhodes Scholar, thought he might become an academic, but then got a job at the ACTU as an industrial officer and advocate in 1958. And within a decade or so, he was the president of the ACTU when it represented about 50% of the Australian workforce. He was described as the second most powerful man in Australia. He was a larrikin figure, an intellectual, someone who aroused strong feelings, was a drinker, a notorious womanizer. And through the 1970s, the idea percolated that he could go into politics one day. He would be the Messiah. And of course, he did that. And he became Prime Minister in 1983, led a government through four terms over 9 years, and is Australia's most popular post-war Prime Minister who left a vast policy legacy.
An amazing story, not only during his time in office, but in the lead up to that. He also came from a very prominent Perth-based family, I believe. His father was a clergyman. He himself was not a particularly religious man. How did he come to identify with sort of left-wing politics, in other words, given his privileged background?
Yeah, look, Bob Hawke told me that he kind of followed what was, I guess we'd call a social gospel. His mother was very community-minded, involved in a number of organisations in South Australia and Western Australia through the 1920s, 30s and 40s. His father, of course, was a clergyman. Bob was actually very deeply religious at school and at university, but he went on a student Christian conference to India in 1952, and I was able to get a copy of to see Bob Hawke's diary from that time as a young man. And that journey to India charted his detachment from organized religion. He couldn't stand the widespread poverty in India, and that led him to break away from the church. He had an uncle, Albert, who was the Premier of Western Australia. So the family was politically minded, interested in current affairs and politics. His uncle was a kind of another father figure in his life. And so the idea of public service in some kind, in some form, was with him through his teen years and early adult years.
Now, there have been a lot of biographies of Bob Hawke published over the years. How do you think your book changes our historic view of the person himself?
Well, I thought that in the final decades of Bob Hawke's life, the kind of myth of Hawke as a larrikin intellectual celebrity superstar had come to overshadow the real man, the light and the shade. I mean, he was someone who had great virtues and is often regarded on both sides of politics as one of our best prime ministers and certainly the best trade union leader in the 1960s and 70s. But he was deeply flawed. He was a terrible father, to three children, a terrible husband to Hazel, his first wife. He was a notorious drinker, often went on the booze, on the benders, and could be just terrible in public, and people saw him with this drinking problem, you know, sometimes drinking 20 beers in one night and embarrassing himself and his friends in public. And he had a womanizing problem. And I say in the book he had a sex addiction. He bedded hundreds, perhaps thousands of women throughout his life. And the thing is, he was open about these flaws. People knew about it. But I go into some detail in the book to describe how bad his personal and private life was, which I don't think detracts from his public achievements. But I think we had lost this part of the Bob Hawke story. And so I set about writing a new book with his cooperation, but it was an independent process. It's not something that he endorsed. He cooperated with me, gave me access to all of his papers. You know, I interviewed his family, his friends, his political and union colleagues, more than 100 people interviewed for the book, and probably looked at about a million pages of archival documents here and overseas. So I hope it's readable, but I tried to make it comprehensive as well and well-researched to give us a new portrait of what I say is the complete or real Bob Hawke.
It's certainly very, very readable. And among the interviews that you undertook were also a number of former international leaders, I believe, including the former Canadian Prime Minister. Can you explain who exactly you spoke with more on the international front to get an understanding of Hawke's profile on the global stage?
Yeah, look, Hawke was a very, very significant international figure. I mean, he's remembered for the big landmark deregulatory economic reforms in the 1980s and big social achievements like creating Medicare and putting the environment on the agenda by saving Daintree and the Kakadu and things like that. But international policy is really critical to the Hawke Prime Ministership. And he was Australia's last Cold War leader. And he had these relationships that he built with people like George Bush and Ronald Reagan, John Major and Margaret Thatcher, Brian Mulroney, the Canadian Prime Minister. He met Mikhail Gorbachev in Russia. He welcomed Nelson Mandela to Australia. He met the great Chinese leaders, whether it's Hu Yaobang or Zhao Ziyang. He went all over the world. He was probably the best known and best travelled Australian Prime Minister up to that point. And he saw himself as someone who had these personal relationships that could play a policy dividend. He really wanted to play a big role on the world stage. And so I was able to test a number of these ideas that Hawke put out there as an international statesman, firstly by looking at the documentary evidence and then doing some interviews. You know, I was lucky to interview George Bush Sr., John Major, and Brian Mulroney and many others who dealt with Hawke on the world stage.
Fascinating. And a generation that's rapidly disappearing as well with the recent death of George Bush Sr. Now, let's take us back to 1983. Bob Hawke comes to power. We're going to be focusing, obviously, on his foreign policy, which you believe was very consequential for Australia, and perhaps you think as well, being the most consequential prime minister in post-World War Australian history in terms of his impact on foreign policy. I wanted to zoom in on that initial relationship with the United States and President Ronald Reagan, who was an ideological crusader. There must have been some degree of apprehension with a new Labour prime minister in Australia, given the legacy that Gough Whitlam had left behind and the sort of fear, I suppose, that Ronald Reagan and others might have felt towards a new Labour prime minister. So how did Bob Hawke handle that?
Well, that's right, Hervé. He was the first Labour Prime Minister after the Whitlam government, which was often chaotic, shambolic, dysfunctional. The Americans actually respected and liked Gough Whitlam, even though they had disagreements on Vietnam and so on. But the Americans had particular issues with a number of the Whitlam government ministers. So it's very interesting that Hawke went on his first overseas trip just months after becoming Prime Minister in 1983 to Washington, D.C., and he wanted to meet Ronald Reagan. He met Ronald Reagan. He met George Shultz, who he'd been friendly with when Hawke was in the trade union movement, and George Shultz, the Secretary of State, had been a leading business figure. So he had that relationship, and I interviewed George Shultz too just before his 100th birthday, and Shultz told me that there was a lot of concern in the Reagan administration about whether Hawke would be another Whitlam and whether he could be trusted on things like maintaining the joint defence facilities in Australia, maintaining the broader architecture around the ANZUS partnership. He reassured Reagan. So Hawke went there himself to give this personal reassurance. And what Hawke said to Reagan is that you can rely on me, you can trust me to be a supporter and an advocate of the alliance. When we have disagreements, I'll be upfront about those and I'll let you know. And it was interesting to actually go to the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and open up Ronald Reagan's diary for that day. And in that diary, there's a short entry where he says that Hawke told him that he was quietly not from the left wing of the Labor Party and they could do business together. And that relationship grew. And in the diary entries in coming years, Reagan writes about how Hawke was a good man and they had a great relationship. And George Bush, when he became Prime Minister, he gave me access to his diaries as well. And that relationship was even more significant. And Bush wrote in his diary about having a special relationship with Bob Hawke. So he won the Americans over.
Mm. And it's interesting as well that he, on his first trip, I believe, to DC, did not take his foreign minister. He took with him Paul Keating, his treasurer. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
And why is that?
Well, it's very interesting. So Bill Hayden, of course, had been the former Labor leader and he became foreign minister. And Hayden wasn't exactly too enthusiastic about the US alliance. Hayden told me that he was skeptical of big powers. And there was some anti-American sentiment within the Labor Party. And I wouldn't necessarily attach Bill Hayden to that, but he was a bit more cautious, a bit more skeptical. He had a few run-ins with senior US administration figures. And so Hawke left Hayden in Canberra and took his young, dynamic, innovative treasurer, Paul Keating, along. And there they sat in the Oval Office with Ronald Reagan and George Bush and built that relationship.
Fascinating. Now, do you think that the Hawke government fundamentally changed Labour's view of the United States and of the US alliance? And would you say that that view still holds to this day? In a sense, I mean, I think at one point you quote Hawke saying, we wanted to be a dependable but not a compliant ally. That's how we wanted to pitch ourselves.
That's right. Hawke wanted to be a respected to lead a respected country on the world stage that was independent in its outlook but also reliable as an ally. So he put the US-Australia relationship first, but he did move the alliance into a new direction, I think, one that was less compliant than it had been under the Malcolm Fraser government or his predecessors. And one of the things they did in terms of reviewing the partnership was to make sure that the joint defence facilities did in fact become joint, that there was shared oversight, shared operation, and intelligence was freely available. So that was important. And Hawke conveyed that clearly to the Americans, that you'll be able to rely on me, but I want more say within that relationship. And the fact that he was so upfront with a Republican administration is pretty significant. And he did the same with Margaret Thatcher, and she respected him a lot. I interviewed her foreign policy advisor, Charles Powell, and Charles Powell said, look, they had a lot of arguments together, but they respected and admired each other because they were upfront. They could talk about differences on things like apartheid, but they could also work well together across the board.
And yet there were early missteps, including one that you write a lot about, which is the proposal for the controversial testing of the MX intercontinental ballistic missile system, which was something being developed by the United States, and they were hoping that they could test this off the waters of Australia, close to Tasmania. This was, I believe, a commitment made by the previous government, by Malcolm Fraser, which Hawke endorsed initially, at least, and yet he couldn't follow through. So, what was the why could he not follow through, and what was the implications that was that did that create any long-standing damage with his new found partnership with the United States?
It's an extraordinary episode in the Hawke government's foreign policy because you've got to take your mind back to the early to mid-1980s. It's a Cold War. There's fear of a nuclear holocaust between the great powers, the Soviet Union and the United States. Ronald Reagan had his plan for the Star Wars defense missile system. There had been big peace marches and rallies throughout Australia. The Nuclear Disarmament Party had a strong showing at the 1984 federal election. There was concern within the Labor Party about the idea that the Hawke government would monitor the splashdown testing of this missile off the Australian coast. And Hawke had given this commitment, had reaffirmed this commitment that had been made by the Fraser administration, but he faced a revolt in his own party. He was not going to be able to carry through on this commitment, so he had to get himself out of it. And he goes to Washington, D.C., and he meets with his old friend, George Shultz, the U.S. Secretary of State, and they work out a form of words for Hawke to crab walk away from the agreement. And the Americans say that they really didn't need Australia's support and assistance anyway, and there was no problem with that. Now, this was embarrassing for Hawke. This was a setback. Some people questioned whether it might have an impact on the alliance. But very interestingly, when I interviewed George Bush, who was then the vice president, of course, and George Shultz, they said there was no impact in the White House. And I should say, I also spoke to James Baker, who was Reagan's chief of staff at that time. And there was no impact on the relationship. They respected Hawke. They realised he had a political problem in Australia. They wanted to help him get out of it. And they didn't want to junk the relationship because of this disagreement. And so it was a masterful display of, you know, political acrobatics that Hawke could walk out of this without any damage done to the relationship. The Americans, in fact, were more upset with New Zealand not allowing their ships to dock in its ports. And that, of course, led to the suspension of the ANZUS partnership with New Zealand.
In some sense, I think the Kiwis helped us out in the sense that the Americans would have been very worried in some sense that ANZUS at large was being threatened and didn't want to disincentivize the Labour Party from a broader commitment towards ANZUS. So this was a small defeat, but in order to preserve a broader relationship, and a relationship which also encompassed the Pine Gap facilities, which was always seen by the Americans, I suppose, as being the much more important, strategically significant assets in Australia and something that really couldn't be compromised at any cost.
Absolutely. That's the main game for the Americans, these joint defence facilities. And they didn't want to put pressure on Hawke that might lead to more resentment within the Labor Party and within his government. That could then lead to questions about whether or not the joint facilities should continue. So they were happy to let that one through to the keeper, so to speak.
Now, beyond this sort of rapprochement, at least between the Labour Party and the United States and the US alliance, Hawke was also significant, at least insofar as he really presented himself, and it appears as if he was successful to a large extent, as a conduit between East and West. That's how you describe it in your book, and you dedicate a lot of pages to this idea that Bob Hawke saw himself as an intermediary more than anything else, not just with China, on which the Australians were ahead of the Americans, but also even with regard to Gorbachev, to the Soviet Union, far more geographically removed from Australia, but it seems as if Bob Hawke had good access there and was also very influential in forming the collective opinion of a number of big Western leaders, including Thatcher and George Bush Sr. at that time. So can you explain how he crafted that role for himself and to what extent you see him as being successful in that role?
Yeah, Hawke believed in institutions. He believed in things like the United Nations, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, the South Pacific Forum, but he put a lot of emphasis on developing personal relationships that he thought could pay a political and policy dividend. So he did see himself as some kind of bridge between the East, that is China and the USSR, and the West, which is the US, UK and Canada. He did present himself as some kind of a Cold War mediator, and he had said to me, and he wrote in his memoirs, that the Chinese and the Russians asked him to pass information back to the United States and the United Kingdom and Canada. So I was a little bit skeptical of this claim, to be honest, but having interviewed people like Brian Mulroney and George Bush, Sr., and then looked at the documentary record, you know, the meeting records between and the correspondence between people like Reagan and Thatcher and Hawke, this actually stacks up. And there are clear examples where he's passing on information to them after he has his meetings with these Chinese or Soviet leaders. And Hawke was respected for having developed those relationships. He'd visited China several times. He hosted senior Chinese leaders in Australia. I think he had more contact with the Chinese government in the mid to late 1980s than any other Western nation. Now, this is not to say that they didn't have their own meetings or their own contacts, but Hawke was someone they listened to. And George Shultz said that to me. They listened to Hawke. They respected his point of views. They wanted to hear what he had to say. So this was pretty extraordinary that here's an Australian Prime Minister who can deal quite regularly on the phone and in person with US presidents and British prime ministers. And I don't think we can say that we've had a prime minister since who had that close relationship, who played that role on the world stage.
Yeah, and the other end of that, or the other half of that equation, was of course the his investment in relationships with the Chinese leadership. This was post Gang of Four, post Mao Zedong, but in particular, you write about Zhao Ziyang, the premier who visited Australia on a number of occasions and who developed quite a close relationship with Bob Hawke, or rather, Bob Hawke really sought to court him and saw potential there. So that this was the beginning, essentially, of an Australian repositioning on China, again, ahead of the US on that front. You could say that it led to decades of prosperity for the Australian economy, but it wasn't as if it was an uncomplicated smooth sailing either, because there was, of course, the Tiananmen Square, which came later in the premiership of Bob Hawke, but that also seems to have at least made him aware of the fact that it wasn't all that he thought it out to be, or this was not going to be political liberalization along with economic reform. So can you step by step maybe unravel what was Bob Hawke's approach towards China? How did that relationship flourish? And then eventually, how did he perhaps revise his understanding of China in light of the crackdown at Tiananmen Square in June 1989?
Hawke was an enthusiast for building Australia-China relations, and he himself would give credit to Gough Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser's governments for starting those relationships and expanding them themselves. Hawke first went to China in 1978 as ACTU president, and he was very enthusiastic about the economic opportunities. And so as prime minister, he was really able to turbocharge that trading relationship, develop the first Chinese joint ventures in any other country, build that iron ore trade, that aluminium trade, and that was very, very significant. He did it because he was able, again, to establish these really close personal relationships with two Communist Party General Secretaries, Hu Yaobang and Zhao Ziyang, as you mentioned. Now, these guys were also enthusiasts for the Australia-China relationship. They also wanted to see a more liberal, I wouldn't say democratic, but a more liberal and a more open China, a reformed China that would come after the economic reforms, Deng Xiaoping's great reform and opening up process. But of course, what happened is that Hu Yaobang fell out of favour with the Chinese leadership in 1987. He was essentially forced out of power. And Zhao Ziyang himself found himself under house arrest at the time of the Tiananmen Square massacre. So these relationships with Hawke that he had developed and the confidence and optimism they all shared, it didn't come to pass. It hit a brick wall with Tiananmen Square. And Hawke told me in his last interview that I did with him for the book, and the last interview he ever gave, was that his heart broke for China. And he was very upset by the Tiananmen Square massacre. And of course, a lot of Australians would remember the tears rolling down his cheeks in the Great Hall in Parliament House at a memorial service as he talked about those events. And I think I provide some new information about what happened in Tiananmen Square and the reaction in the bureaucracy and in Hawke's office, because he famously read out a cable to the public, which hadn't obviously been made public, and there were some doubts about its veracity later on. But Hawke was very upset about what happened with China, and the relationship then went into a deep freeze. I wouldn't say he was naive, but he was certainly optimistic, and he did again develop those relationships which paid an economic dividend for Australia.
Seems very much a bygone era, given where we're at now in terms of the deterioration in Australia-China relations.
And that's an important point to make. It's a different China today. They have different types of leaders. And a lot of people, I think, reading this book, and you know, I was able to get access for the first time to the dialogue of Hawke's discussions with the Chinese leaders, might be surprised about the things they're saying to each other, because it does hark back to a very different China than the one we see today.
Yeah, at one point you cite a figure, though, in 1984, I think it was, the trade between Australia and China more than doubled, or I don't exactly remember the statistic, but it was an incredible sort of shotgun to, or starting gun rather, to this economic relationship, which certainly lasted more than two decades and is increasingly under strain and question, I suppose, now with how geopolitics are changing. I mean, Bob Hawke also functioned at a very, and he admits himself in his correspondence with Ronald Reagan in your book, you mentioned the fact that he sees himself he saw Ronald Reagan and himself as two leaders at a particular juncture in global history, very fortuitous in a way, when it looked as if, you know, the Soviet Union was coming under strain, was certainly reforming under Gorbachev. It wasn't clear then that it was going to dissolve entirely, but it did seem as if there was a real detente at hand here, a real thaw, a real opportunity for global integration to prevail, for that sort of early end of history narrative, which then became the dominant narrative as the Cold War fell. So how much of what he did and how he conceived of Australia as a global middle power was more a reflection of the particular time in which he functioned versus a philosophy which would still have relevance today, I guess is a big question here.
Yeah, look, Bob Hawke found himself the Prime Minister in the final decade of the Cold War. And it was a great era of international politics and leadership. I mean, we haven't had that roll call of leaders, people like Mulroney, Nakasone, Gorbachev, Mandela, Thatcher, Reagan, Bush, and Hawke. And when I talked to Brian Mulroney, who's the last of the West's Cold War leaders alive, he said Bob Hawke is part of that group. He's a big figure in that group. He's respected and trusted by all of them. And so they had the intellectual capacity, the leadership skills, and the communication skills to see an opening coming. That's how George Shultz described it, an opening coming. And that opening was not only a new style of leadership in China, led by Deng Xiaoping, but also a new leadership in the Soviet Union with Mikhail Gorbachev coming to power after a period of short-term Soviet leaders. But it's very, very interesting because the Chinese leadership prioritized economic reform before political reform, whereas the Soviet Union prioritized political reform before economic reform. And that was a mistake. And Hawke said that to Gorbachev in the Kremlin in 1987. They conducted a tour de horizon of international geopolitics. And they talked at length about all of these issues. And Hawke said to me, backed up again by documents, that Gorbachev instinctively understood that. But he was still kind of had one step in the old Soviet order and one foot in a new Soviet order that he was trying to build, but it had simply overwhelmed him and then it collapsed. And, you know, I was amazed to find that Hawke is actually talking to Gorbachev on the phone while those series of coups and upheavals are happening in 1991 to say that, you know, we're with you, Australia is on your side, and Gorbachev is saying, you know, thanks, I appreciate the support. And it's incredible. But Hawke thought Gorbachev had made a number of missteps along the way and was partly responsible for his own downfall.
And of course, I think Gorbachev lost power, or at least the Soviet Union was formally dissolved a few days after Bob Hawke stepped down as Prime Minister. Is that right?
So that's right.
Their political fates were somewhat intertwined, but very different insofar as for Gorbachev, it marked the end of his country. For Bob Hawke, at least, it was a peaceful transfer of power and Australian democracy. Now, there were other sort of issues which really, I think, intrigued Bob Hawke and were often seen by his civil service as being rather tangential to Australia's direct interests. So I'm thinking about the Middle East here, where Bob Hawke saw himself as a sort of potential peacemaker. At one point in discussions with President Mubarak of Egypt, he is flouting his idea for a confederation of the Palestinians. He was a proponent of the two-state solution, and he was thinking perhaps a Palestinian state can be a confederation with Jordan. That elicited a lot of skepticism from his civil service, from his advisors. And he actually brings in President Mubarak to, in some ways, lecture his advisors that this was actually, after all, not a bad idea.
It's a incredible story, Hervé. I mean, it is amazing because Hawke, in the 1970s, had expressed his profound love and admiration for Israel. The Middle East was Hawke's foreign policy priority as ACTU president. He was known for it. He wept openly for Israel and was involved with a number of senior Israeli prime ministers and political leaders. So he had developed those relationships. And he thought, actually at his first press conference as prime minister in 1983, he thought he could play a role as a peacemaker in the Middle East. But his staff thought this was a madcap, crazy idea that had really no purpose for Australia's foreign policy outside of any kind of sphere of influence or priority that we should have as a nation. So they downplayed the idea. And Hawke would often say to his staff, you know, when are we going to the Middle East? I've got to meet my great friends in the region. And they kept downplaying the idea and saying, next year, Bob, next year. And by 1987, they finally let him go. And of course, knowing Bob and his approach as an international statesman in his eyes, he thought he could bring peace to the Middle East. Now, of course, that didn't happen. It was never going to happen, but he pursued it. And he even tried to mediate during the Gulf War as well. He thought he could stop the US and its allies trying to repel Iraq from Kuwait. So he had these dreams of playing a bigger role on the world stage, even though he had already played a big role. And on things like stopping mining in Antarctica or ending apartheid in South Africa or setting up APEC, he had already demonstrated and would demonstrate his great international credentials to play this role. But peace in the Middle East was one achievement that eluded him.
He wasn't the first and he wouldn't be the last. That goal has eluded many and continues to. Now, you've already mentioned as well, he was very active on apartheid, on trying to dismantle that system through the Commonwealth heads of government. And that's also where he famously clashed with Margaret Thatcher. So can you explain that relationship between Margaret Thatcher and Bob Hawke in relation to apartheid? Of course, Mandela then, once freed and once apartheid collapsed, also visited Australia, but it seemed as if it wasn't initially his plan to do so, that he was actually more intent on visiting the rest of Asia, and it was an afterthought to come to Australia.
Well, this is where you get the great stories when you delve deep into the documents, and it was pretty interesting to find that the UK government, in their dispatches sending back to Margaret Thatcher and in the briefing papers her office are presenting her, they really didn't have high hopes for Bob Hawke as Prime Minister. They thought he would only be in power for a short period. They thought he was too much of a larrikin, a womaniser. They didn't believe that he'd given up the drink, which he did when he became Prime Minister. So there wasn't high hopes for that relationship. And they met for the first time on the sidelines of the CHOGM meeting in New Delhi in 1983. And what was extraordinary about that is that Thatcher liked Hawke and Hawke liked her. They were intellectual giants, both very proud, often stubborn, could be inflexible, and they stuck to their guns on issues and they liked to argue and they had some blazing rows. Apartheid was not an area where they could make a lot of progress, although they did through CHOGM, but there was a lot of disagreements between them, but they still nevertheless respected each other. And in fact, Margaret Thatcher didn't actually like his predecessor, Malcolm Fraser, all that much, even though he was a conservative. She liked Bob Hawke more. So he was able to develop that relationship. And, of course, working through Chocolate, they did apply those financial sanctions, which was an idea that Hawke had, to put the tighten the economic screws on South Africa to dismantle racial segregation. It was something he believed in as a very, very young man. He pursued it in the ACTU years as well. He opposed the Springbok rugby union team visiting Australia, for example. And as Prime Minister, he got to continue this campaign that he had begun to end apartheid. And he worked with Brian Mulroney and many others to see it happen. And Hawke, I think, probably did embellish a little bit his role on apartheid. It was important and significant, but he wasn't the only one who was involved in that campaign. And when Nelson Mandela was freed, he did a tour of nations around the world that had given him support. And I was amazed to find in the National Archives in Canberra that some of the briefings and letters there said that Mandela wasn't planning to visit Australia. And he got a very tough letter from Gareth Evans, who was then the Foreign Minister, saying, listen, mate, basically, we've done a lot for you and supported you, often at our government's own cost because it was a contentious issue, and you really need to come to Australia on your first visit. And Mandela reconsidered that pretty quickly, and he did come to Australia and he did meet Hawke. And at a number of public events, he praised Hawke and the role he had played in ending apartheid.
Yeah, fascinating history there. And you talk about Thatcher and the mutual respect they had for each other. It's interesting as well that Bob Hawke got on well with Neil Kinnock, who was Thatcher's opposition at the time, British Labour. British Labour was trying to pivot at that time. It was a prototype early New Labour. And they were looking towards Australia, looking towards Bob Hawke as a more practical, progressive, constructive version of Labour politics. And I think Neil Kinnock agreed fundamentally with Bob Hawke that principle mattered less or mattered little if you don't have power. So you need to have both really to enact change. One of the smaller details which I found fascinating was in your book was the fact that there was a young Tony Blair and a young Gordon Brown at that time, sort of acolytes or junior members of up and coming members, I should say, of Labour in Britain under Neil Kinnock. But of course, their relationship was famously troubled as well in office. And there were some parallels there, I think, between Bob Hawke and Paul Keating. It's amazing how history went on to echo in similar ways in British Labour. But what was the, can you explore that in a bit more detail? I mean, so it is a very brief part of your book, but that link between New Labour and Bob Hawke seems interesting.
You're right to say that in the 1980s, what was happening in Australia was closely observed by the UK Labour Party. And when Tony Blair did come to power in 1997, there's been a lot of commentary and discussion about how he was following Bill Clinton. But in fact, the first model was really Bob Hawke and Paul Keating. And I was able to interview Tony Blair actually when I wrote my biography of Paul Keating, and he confirmed that. But I had a wonderful interview with Neil Kinnock in London at his home as I was researching the book, and he admired Bob Hawke and was paying close attention to what was happening in Australia and met Hawke a number of times when he did come to London. And he did send two of his young shadow ministers, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, to Australia to observe what was happening and report back. And they met with Bob Hawke and they met with Paul Keating. They absorbed the transformed Labour Party and then went back and tried to apply those lessons. I should say, Kinnock had a lot of respect for Hawke, but he was often uncomfortable with how Hawke and Thatcher got along. They were close, they were friendly, and particularly there was a dinner, I think, in 1987 where Thatcher and Hawke were toasting each other to excess, laying it on with a trowel, as you would expect. And Kinnock was invited, and he was very uncomfortable with these two political figures, one very conservative, one sort of a centrist left figure, praising each other so much in his company.
Yes, exactly. I think he said, "Steady on, Bob. You can praise your enemies from above, but never from the side, and certainly not from below." I thought that was rather cryptic, but obviously scathing as well. Fascinating detail there. Look, I want to return to Asia now, because one of the big legacies of Bob Hawke's premiership and his stamp on foreign policy was the creation of APEC. But the prelude to that was equally fascinating. One of the thorns in the side of that relationship with the United States was something called the Export Enhancement Program. Perhaps you can describe that in a bit more detail, but basically it was mirrored closely to the European Community's common agricultural policy as well. These were sort of protectionist initiatives aimed at each other. So US and Europe caught in a bit of a trade war, and Australia ostensibly the collateral damage. Is that correct?
That's right. So of course, Australia's agricultural sector was very significant for the Australian economy, very export-oriented. That was changing, obviously, through the 1970s and 80s, but it was still a big part of our economy, and they had a vocal constituency in Australia, which was the farming community. And, of course, Australia was caught in this trade war between Europe and the United States. And as Hawke often said, you know, sometimes one of these missiles would land in Australia, and you know, our wheat or our wool and other commodities would be damaged and not given access to the markets that they wanted overseas. So Hawke didn't make a lot of progress like his predecessors with the United States or with Europe. You know, he pushed the case very, very strongly. He did it publicly. He did it personally in meetings. He wrote letters. I've seen the letters where he's essentially begging Reagan and Bush to ease up on the subsidy war. And eventually Hawke hit a brick wall. He wasn't getting anywhere. So he did try to use the Uruguay round of the GATT process. And out of that came an initiative called the Cairns Group of Trading Agricultural Nations, which Canada was a part of. And that did help to sort of loosen up some of the sort of trade restrictions around the world. And then that then opened up the floodgates, and Hawke wanted to take that even further by establishing APEC, which he did at a ministerial level in 1989. So these things were also very, very significant. Hawke made the case, and when that case wasn't being receptive, he found another route, and that was to join with other countries to push for multilateral trade liberalisation.
And it's fascinating as well, the fact was that the Americans were not initially invited to join the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, APEC, nor were they necessarily briefed on this. And this triggered some alarm, I think, in DC. And in your book, Gareth Evans recalls a colorful conversation with James Baker in which he says, "If you think you can screw us around like this, you don't know what an alliance relationship is all about." So clearly the Americans were not best pleased by initially, at least by these efforts to create what in Bob Hawke's eyes was meant to be an alternative to basically the OECD club of wealthy nations, but for the Asia Pacific. So I thought that was an interesting facet in that sort of US-Australia relationship and the tensions between, on the one hand, the rekindling of the alliance with Australia forging its own sort of middle power, independent foreign policy in our region. Now, I guess where I would end with this, eventually that was reconciled and the Americans were invited to APEC, but all this institution building is really coming under strain. I mean, APEC has under-delivered. It's been, I think, quite disappointing. It was perhaps disappointing to Bob Hawke as well within his lifetime after office. It seems very much like a bygone era. Is there any legacy of Bob Hawke? I mean, do you think there are lessons that we can still learn from Bob Hawke and his foreign policy? Might have been right then, but is any of that still relevant today? Is that something that we can still, those traditions, something that we can still draw on, given how global politics in our region has changed to such an extent since that time?
I think APEC was initially very successful in the early to mid 1990s. And of course, Paul Keating as Prime Minister worked with other leaders to elevate it to a leaders summit. And they did make good progress initially. But you're right. I mean, Hawke surveyed the international community at the end of his life and found it wanting for leadership. He couldn't name a great leader around the world. There was no Bush, no Reagan, no Thatcher, no Gorbachev, no Mandela. They're all gone. And he was very despondent on the capacity for there to be, for great leaders to come together and work together to resolve differences and make progress. And that speaks to, I think, another legacy point of Hawke's, is that he really did develop these close relationships. And we've talked about a lot of policy initiatives and even issues like the MX missile step back. These things could only be resolved and progress could only be made because he had developed those close relationships. Now, it is absurd to think that Scott Morrison or any of his Liberal or Labor predecessors would be in such regular contact with Joe Biden or Donald Trump or Barack Obama. They're just not. They haven't been. And so I guess that is a lesson for foreign policy is to put the effort in to meeting leaders, to talking to them, to getting to know them. Because when you have those relationships, you can make significant policy progress.
Personalities matter. Now, my final question to you, and that's related actually, Troy, is would a politician like Bob Hawke survive in today's Australian politics?
Look, it's a good question. Hawke was certainly larger than life. He was a very good prime minister, and I write a lot about this in the book. He's very good at administering a cabinet, running a public service, overseeing an office, coming up with policy ideas with his very talented cabinet, implementing them and communicating them effectively to the voters. But he was deeply flawed. I mean, he did have a problem with the drink, which he did give up when he became Prime Minister, but he didn't give up the infidelity. And I think our community standards have changed. I think the media standards have changed. And so for Hawke to be successful today, he would have to, I guess, continue to tame those demons that he struggled with his entire life. But there is a lot to learn from Bob Hawke about his prime ministership and about his life. He was authentic. People thought he had credibility. He never pretended to be someone that he wasn't. He worked very hard. He had a good group of public servants and staff and ministers, but he did really have a great capacity for political leadership. And that really is one of the key lessons in the book. It's about leadership, what leadership is, what it looks like, because it's been in short supply in recent years, and what we can learn from someone like Bob Hawke.
Troy Bramston, thank you so much for that tour d'horizon of Bob Hawke and his era and the global politics that pervaded and Australia's influence in that, which is a totally fascinating chapter of history. Grateful for your time and your thoughts. The book is Bob Hawke, Demons and Destiny. This has been an episode of Lowy Institute Conversations. As usual, thank you to Josh Godding for his superb technical assistance, and please join us next time.